You're listening to episode 99 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hello, my dear listeners. We are one episode away from our 100th episode coming up on August 10th. And guess which podcast is turning 2 years old? Yeah, us. I am so excited. For the 100th episode, we're doing a fun mashup that includes your voice messages. A huge heartfelt thank you to you if you submitted a voice message. They got me so emotional and I was tearing up. I can't wait for you to hear how inspiring you all are. I also wanted to take a moment to welcome our new listeners. If you're new to our show, I am so happy to have you here. I encourage you to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/archive to browse through our library of episodes. For all of my listeners who've been with us for a while, thank you for hanging out with us every week. And a huge air hug to our amazing listeners who've recommended and shared our podcast with friends and left really awesome iTunes reviews. Producing a podcast takes a lot of time, and we put a lot of heart and soul into making it. I am so touched to know that you appreciate our work. For listeners who haven't had the chance yet, I would love to ask for your support in taking a moment to subscribe to 88 Cups of Tea on iTunes and leave a rating and a review. When you take those specific actions, that really helps our show become more visible to new listeners who haven't heard of us before. And it goes without saying, thank you so much for helping us grow our community. I really appreciate it. On to the next part of our intro. If you'd love to support our show and rock some 88 Cups of Tea swag, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/mug to get your limited edition mug signed by yours truly. If you're looking for a sense of family with a bunch of people who understand the highs and lows of being a writer, you should join a private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I love this community of ours, and I always have the best time checking in to hear how everyone is doing. We check in almost every day to talk about our work in progress, our latest achievements, current reads, and so much more. We honestly have the most encouraging and supportive members in our group, so you don't want to miss out on this special community. Come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. As a side note, I am very protective of our private Facebook group and do my very best to weed out any spam or fake profiles. So be sure to answer all three questions when you click to join, and please make sure to have a clear photo of yourself in your profile picture. If you're worried about your privacy on Facebook and don't have a photo of yourself in your profile picture, I totally understand. Just private message me links to your other social media accounts like Twitter or Instagram so I know you're a real person. Now that little PSA is over, I am so excited to hang out with you in our Facebook group. Again, that's facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I can't wait to meet you in there. And on to today's episode. Henna Khan is an award-winning picture book and middle grade author whose work includes an Islam-themed picture book for the Curious George Books. Henna was tapped to write the first release of Simon & Schuster's groundbreaking imprint, Salam Reads, where she wrote the highly acclaimed middle grade novel called Amina's Voice. In Amina's Voice, a Pakistani-American Muslim girl named Amina has never been comfortable in the spotlight. She's happy just hanging out with her best friend, Sujin. Except now that she's in middle school, everything feels different. Sujin is suddenly hanging out with Emily, one of the cool girls in the class, and even talking about changing her name to something more American. Does Amina need to start changing too? Or hiding who she is to fit in? While Amina grapples with these questions, she is devastated when her local mosque is vandalized. Amina's Voice brings to life the joys and challenges of a young Pakistani-American and highlights the many ways in which one girl's voice can help bring a diverse community together to love and support each other. Henna and I discuss the inspiration behind Amina's Voice and her universal story of self-acceptance and the acceptance of others. We also talk about how Henna introduces Islam to her young readers, and we continue to talk about how important it is to have diverse representation in children's literature. Further into our conversation, Henna walks us through how she strengthens her character's voice by knowing exactly what they want. And we touch on ways that writers can instill accountability to inspire a finished story. For those of you who are currently looking for writing groups to be a part of, Henna shares the specific characteristics of writing groups you should look out for when finding your perfect group. Now let's dive right in. Hey, listeners, we have Henna Khan with us today. How are you, Henna?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
I am very excited to have you here. I came across your work because I saw your name listed in the NPR's list for authors who wrote really kick-ass books for young readers that ties in with social activism and awareness. Do you mind if we can kick off by starting off with a snapshot that you can share for our listeners to hear about if they haven't picked up your book yet?
Sure. The story is about a 12-year-old girl named Amina who lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin with her parents, who are Pakistani immigrants. So they moved to this country before she was born. And just a girl dealing with very relatable middle school challenges, like who her friends are and where she fits in. Her best friend is a Korean-American girl named Soo-jin, who's talking about suddenly changing her name to something more American. And she's also befriending a girl who's never been nice to her in Amina, so that's throwing her. At the same time, she's dealing with challenges at home with her older brother starting high school and bringing some attitude into the house that's stressing out her parents, along with an uncle who's visiting from overseas who her parents are, you know, really bent on impressing. So it's a lot for this little 12-year-old to handle. But the biggest overarching challenge is that she has this beautiful singing voice and she's very, very musical, but she's got terrible stage fright and is afraid to showcase her talent. And that's what she really dreams of doing. And at the same time, like you mentioned, the book is a window into a culture that a lot of people aren't very familiar with or have a lot of access to, being Pakistani American and Muslim. So you get an insider's view into this family and the mosque community that they're a part of that's very special to them. And ultimately, that community is attacked. And that's a part of the story, although it's not the overarching purpose of the story.
Thank you so much for that. That was beautifully said. I know that Simon Schuster, they created Salam Reads. That's a Muslim children's imprint that your book, Amina's Voice, was the debut.
Yes. Yeah. I was really excited about that. So I was so excited about the imprint.
I know. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, it was such a huge thing to have happen at all. Salam Reads exists was amazing. And then it was such an honor to have Amina's Voice kick it off too. It was a very special place to be.
Being especially the debut author, and I feel you probably have spoken to them a lot about this. Do you know what inspired them to go ahead and execute on this idea and bring forth Salam Reads? Because it is really important, especially for our political climate right now.
It really was. And it was interesting because talking to Zareen Jaffrey, the editor of Salam Reads, before we knew that it was happening. So she was already considering my manuscript at that time. And I learned about Salam Reads the same time everyone else did. And she hinted and told me that she had big news. And I thought maybe it was another deal or something else. The news was embargoed until the New York Times announced it. I learned a few weeks or, you know, not much more time before she made the offer on my book. And at the time, I was floored and excited and overwhelmed like everybody else who heard about it. And I had people from all over saying, did you hear about this? Just exciting news. Over time, I got to speak with her more and understand what was happening. And really was something that she'd been thinking about, that her publisher, Justin, at Simon & Schuster had been thinking about, really in reaction to a lot of the other stories out there that paint Muslims in such a horrible way. Mm-hmm. A lot of the literature even that is heavily Islamophobic. And I think it's a very deliberate attempt on their part to challenge that with other stories and to really try to bring other Muslim voices from all backgrounds and really to try to bring a variety of voices that are not being heard at all out there. So really, it was, like you're saying, very much a reaction to the climate that we're in, sadly.
I'm so grateful that they have this right now. How did Amina's Voice come about?
I had been thinking about a character like her and a story like hers for some time. And I had written a few picture books about, you know, Muslims and Muslim traditions, which I was, you know, really happy to publish. But I wanted to be able to explore a character in a middle grade format just because you have more room and more space to introduce themes. Also, when I was that age, that was when books really spoke to me the most. And I really wanted to reach that age group with a story like this. And for me, like I described, you know, in many ways, just very relatable, regular kid, which was important to me. I wanted anyone to be able to identify with her, no matter what their background was. I was very much aware of the fact that these stories don't exist, that Muslim kids don't see themselves in the literature for the most part. I would have loved to have read a book like this when I was a kid. And then the whole idea of knowing what was happening. I wrote this book 4.5 years ago, so things were different than they are now even. But there was still growing Islamophobia in this country, and I was very concerned about that, not liking what I was seeing, and really believing, as I do, that stories have the power to change hearts and minds. I was just hoping that a story like hers could hopefully create some compassion and tolerance and understanding of people who I felt were so misunderstood. And even something like the mosque that I mentioned before, so much confusion around what is a mosque and what do people do there and what is Sharia law, or like things like that, that if you don't know, it can be completely overwhelming and scary and sometimes are presented as scary things. And I wanted people to see and get to know and hopefully love this regular Pakistani American Muslim family and see that they're not very different from them.
There's something I actually wanted to mention too. Especially right now with Trump, there's just so much more fear happening and being encouraged. It's such total BS and it just angers me. It started resurfacing where Bush made a speech September 20th or something, right after 9/11. And how back then we were all, oh God, Bush. Most of us were like, oh Lord, Bush. But now with Trump, we're like, Bush said some good things.
Amazing things, right? Yeah.
He made that speech about we should respect the Muslim faith. Muslim teachings are good. Terrorists are traitors to their own faith, he said. I'm like, what is happening today? If Bush was saying that, what is happening now? And that's why I'm so excited and thrilled that your book, Amina's Voice, is out there, because it goes along with what Bush's speech was. And I'll link it to your show notes page as well. In case listeners, you're curious about the speech or you might have forgotten about it, you should revisit it. And it's really about seeing us, as Americans, and shouldn't be singled out because stereotype. You did it in a way, like you said, in a way that it's not overwhelming, but it's an understanding way. I am curious about Amina herself. Was she inspired by yourself when you were younger? Do you love singing yourself?
In some ways, she's inspired by me. I guess her shyness and inhibition comes from me. Her relationships, the friendship part of her and how much that matters to her was inspired by my life. Her friendship with Soo Jin is actually modeled after a friendship I had when I was in elementary school. So definitely pieces of her life resemble mine. And also the uncle who comes to visit was modeled after my uncle. In terms of overall, as a character, she's fictional, and the love of music is not at all related to me. I'm horribly unmusical. I wish I had talent. My older son is very musical. It came from him, actually, and seeing from a young age, and I actually had this in an earlier draft that I cut from the story, but I had included this in there because as a baby, even, he was so moved by music, and he would hear, even in the dishwasher, when it would be clanging dishes in a rhythmic way, he would say, "Music, Mama." He would hear music in the dishwasher. And back then we used to actually listen to CDs in the car. So there was a pause, you know, between each song, and he would say more because he just loved music and never wanted it to stop. And he grew up to, you know, playing instruments, and he doesn't sing, but he does play and he has perfect pitch. And seeing that as somebody who has zero musical talent.
I'm in that tone deaf club with you. Don't even worry about it.
It's so fascinating to see someone who just has that gift. And I do see it that way. And really the other reason I wanted to include it in the story is because I introduced the idea through her uncle, who is more conservative than her parents and traditional in many ways, the fact that he comes from overseas and questions her love for music and even challenges the idea of whether or not it's Islamic. The reason I included that was because I had heard from a friend of mine when my children were much younger and I was considering their Islamic education, and like there's programs like, you know, the one Amina goes to at her mosque where you can enroll your kids. And I was looking for a place that would be a good fit, but also wary of what my kids might be taught and whether these teachers were well-trained, or when I was a kid, if it was just someone's parent who decided they were an authority. So somebody had mentioned to me, right? Somebody had mentioned to me how their nephew had been in a class and somebody had said something to the effect of music being discouraged. And I thought, gosh, here's my son who adores music, and we encourage it, and we take him to music lessons, and we, you know, I drive him to another city to get him the best teach. What if he had been taught that? And so I decided to use that in the story as an example, a small example, but just to introduce the idea that Muslims, just like any people of any faith, we disagree on how we practice and how we interpret things. It's a smaller example, but of course, it's reflective of bigger ideas. That's why you see Muslims of all varieties and all levels of practice and all types of traditions, because we are not a monolith in any way. And one story can't represent all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you have a scene that you struggled with in Amina's Voice that was probably the most difficult scene for you, or was it more of a smooth sailing process for you?
I think when I went back, and I actually wrote the book in third person voice first. That was the original version that we submitted for publication and the one that collected a bunch of rejections. And it was funny, like looking back at the time, I'd written it, I'd revised it, I'd re-revised it, and I thought it was ready to go. When I finally sat with it for a while after getting the rejections, but not getting anything consistent that I could work with, you know, in terms of I got, oh, I love this book and it made me cry and it's beautiful and the writing is beautiful, but I just can't publish anything like this because it's not what we do. Or I don't connect with her and her voice doesn't, got such disparate information. It really left me wringing my hands and not knowing what to do. And it took a while to figure out what was missing. And I had the help of the women in my writer's group who are amazing. They pointed out that I was missing what Amina wanted in the story. And that she was too much of a bystander in her own story. And I knew it was a quiet story and I knew she was a shy, inhibited person, but I think I had left out what made her her. And when I went back and tried to add that in, I didn't like her anymore. Like something about it changed and I was like, this isn't working. So I went back and actually rewrote the entire story in the first person voice. When I did that, I was able to cut out a lot of unnecessary details that had snuck in there. And I think things that maybe I was telling myself, maybe it was a novice mistake, that's parts of the story that I needed to tell, but now knew and could cut out or just refer to and not elaborate on in the new version, that really allowed me to stay in her mind. I guess to answer your question, certain parts, as I went back that second time, I could see the places where I struggled more or had something in there that was maybe for a purpose to explain something. And I tried to get rid of that as much as I could and just really focus on her and her feelings and what drove the story forward and less of that telling stuff.
And how long was that entire process?
First draft to the final draft that was submitted and ultimately accepted, I would say, was about 3 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Were you writing full time?
At the time, no. I've only been writing full-time for about a year now. Before that, I was always either working part-time as a consultant or like the year that Amina's voice was bought, I was working full-time for the first time in a very long time. I'd worked in public health and public health communications for many years. I'd either been doing that in a part-time or full-time or consulting capacity.
What is your schedule like? If there's anything you can share about how you made intentional time to go through with your story and to make sure your book was completed.
I mean, I hear people and I see people on Twitter who are like, I wrote 3,000 words today, you know, whatever it is. And I want to cry because I'm not that person.
Oh God, me neither.
I struggle a lot with consistency and accountability and just staying on track. I had to learn the hard way that I need to set myself deadlines. It really helps me to have someone else to be accountable to. And even this first draft of Amina's Voice, I was actually critiquing Friend's middle grade novel that was already accepted for publication. It was her second novel. She was sending me chunks of her book and I was sending her Amina's Voice, the very first draft at the same time. And because we knew that we had every 2 weeks that we were going to submit, I wanted to stay on track. And that's what got my first draft done. And I wonder if I didn't do that, if it might have taken me a lot longer or what distractions might have come along.
Yeah.
Pull me away, because I think especially because I got my start in children's writing as a writer for hire. I was working for Scholastic book clubs and I got spoiled by that in that I knew that the books I was writing were going to be published because I was hired to write them. It was for a series. And so this whole idea of writing into this vacuum, you know, that you never know if anything's going to come out of it, I found so hard to overcome. And I did it and I wrote several picture books. I have a stack of work that hasn't been published. But Amina's Voice was the first, I would say second, actually. I started another YA novel draft that I kind of abandoned halfway. And then this was the second novel that I picked up. You know, in terms of staying with it, I must have been consulting at the time and doing other things. And what I tried to do was compartmentalize a little bit. So when I was doing a consulting job, I would try to focus on that. And if I wasn't, then I would try to focus on the creative writing. I'm not one of those people who had a schedule. I admire those people. And I also find them a little intimidating where they get up and go for their morning run and then sit down with their coffee and crank out 3,000 words. I wish I had that kind of discipline, but I don't. And I also just feel like life is always pulling me, like most people, like in different directions, like whether it's family commitments or father was ill and trying to help with his care and things like that. In the midst that I think of things that everyone deals with. All the writers out there, I completely understand how hard it can be. But I think at the end of the day, what got me through it was when I got the rejections and I was debating whether to move on to something new or stick with this. Ultimately, I was like, I put so much into this already. I'm not willing to let it go. And I love this character and I want to see it come to life. And so it was that I think, desire that made me go back and redo it again. If you try to trick yourself, if you're like me, what I had to do was come up with ways that I was accountable and giving myself deadlines, since I realized that's the only way I would get things done. Finding the friend who I was going to submit to, or asking my agent, even when I was doing revisions for him, please give me a deadline. Don't just make it a when you can get to it. Tell me when you need this by and I'll get it done. So sometimes that helps to have other people. And for those of you who are writers who don't have a writer's group, I cannot recommend having one enough.
How did you find yours? Do you have any tips on how to find a writer's group that would vibe? Because I know that not all writer's group will vibe. It's almost like a blind date when you think about it. Mm-hmm. It's like, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, you kind of have to move on and not feel guilty about leaving.
Yeah, totally. And mine didn't. I had one that didn't work out. And actually, and writing group may even be intimidating. I'm even a writing partner. That has worked well for me too. In addition to the friend I mentioned, the published author who I was helping prior to that, I met a woman at a writing workshop and she and I hit it off. We started meeting and exchanging work with each other, and that helped me a lot. Anything that I think helps you talk about your craft, have someone critique it and give you feedback and then keep you on track and keep you motivated during those times where you just don't want to do it, I think is really helpful. So for me, you know, she was helpful. This other friend was helpful. And then I had another writing group that individuals were wonderful. But like you're saying, like the way it just gelled wasn't working. And I think the composition wasn't working. Like where we were in our professional progress, I guess, was very varied. So it was hard. And we tried it. I did gain from it. But I think eventually it kind of fizzled. And then the group I have now is a group that I actually started asking around. And I asked other authors I knew who were in groups if they had any openings. It was almost
aww,
like,
I love that. Hey, do you have room at the lunch table for me?
Totally, totally. And I said that. And a few of them were like, sorry.
On Wednesdays, we were pink. So no.
Exactly. Yeah, and in some cases, it wouldn't have worked for me because they were meeting every week or they were meeting at a time that wouldn't work for me. So eventually, like through asking around, I was connected to the group of women who I'm with now, which is just lovely because we meet once a month. It's not every week or every 2 weeks even. And we're small enough. There's only four of us. So we can, some groups I know had like 13 people in them. And I always wonder, how do you critique everyone's work in a significant way if it's that many people? But I guess they figured it out. But it is a process, I think, to find a group that works. I really can't say enough how much it's helped me.
I'm thrilled you finally found a really good writing group. And I think four people is really good. I know you mentioned workshops just now. Do you have any workshops or retreat experiences that you can swear by or that you just fell in love with?
Unfortunately, no. And that's something that I've been thinking about a lot recently and was talking with my husband about this, actually, because I was telling him how it's amazing to be at the point where I am right now, where people want to hear from me, you know, and like ask me to be on panels or to even lead writing workshops, which I've done. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, I still want to learn and learn from people who are better than me. I'm hoping to actually partake in more now. But I think just because of life before and the way it was and trying to juggle everything. And to be honest, I think I didn't really fully embrace myself as a writer. I think it was a combination of really serious imposter syndrome, but then also just not committing to it 100%. I always included it among the things that matter to me very much, but it was like, I'm a public health professional and I'm on the board of this nonprofit and I'm a writer and I write children's books. And so it really, it wasn't something that I invested in wholeheartedly in terms of time and energy and everything. It was something that I did. I really feel it was fear of failure and other things. So I did take a few workshops and I was a member of the Children's Book Guild of Washington, D.C. That I would say was overwhelmingly the best experience I've had. But again, that was like after I was published. You had to be published twice in order to join the guild. Since I had the picture books under my belt, I was able to do that. And just that experience of going to meetings, hearing from the people they invited, whether they were editors or agents or other authors, talking about their experiences, I really benefited from. And then just the network of authors who were willing to give advice, talk about their experiences with an agent, a different publisher, was really helpful to me. But in terms of actual classes or anything that I took, I really didn't love anything that I did. And I didn't do too many. I'm still hoping to more. So if other people have stuff to recommend to me.
I'm sure you'll find it though. Because I do hear there are some really great ones out there. I heard about Squaw Valley. They seem to have a pretty solid retreat / conference that goes on there. I think I remember hearing Amy Tan started off there. And I'm a huge fan of Amy Tan's work. So that's how I became aware about Squaw. SQUAW. And if you don't mind, you did bring up the word imposter syndrome, and that really hit a soft spot for me because a lot of us do understand what that's like. And I think it's especially not just as writers, but as artists overall. For you, were you struggling with imposter syndrome all the way till you became published, or were you able to break out of it before you became a published author?
Oh, no, no. I think I still struggle with it.
What? You still do?
Definitely. And I think I felt I was very fortunate to start off writing for hire, but I think part of me was like, oh, well, you know, I'm just a writer for hire. Because people would ask me, where can I get your books? I was like, well, you have to sign up through Scholastic Book Clubs, you know, through your kid's school. It wasn't like go to Barnes & Noble or to your local bookstore and find it on the shelf. I couldn't call myself an author, even though I had authored several books. I would refer to myself as a writer. And then I had my first picture book published. And even still, I thought, well, maybe it's just a one-hit wonder, you know, or whatever. Yeah. Like, I'm never going to get published again. And so really each time I think that was that fear that, you know, well, this won't happen again. I would say only yesterday, maybe, I thought, okay, I think I'm good for a little while because I know that I have other books in the work. But even then, honestly, like the idea that, well, maybe after that, you know, no one will want to hear from me anymore. I think it's a hard thing to that voice, that self-doubting voice in your mind is a hard thing to quiet.
What do you define as literary success? Because I do feel like imposter syndrome is set up by what we imagine, our own perspective of what literary success means to each of us individually.
Well, I think, and in this sense, I don't mean to downplay all the love my books have gotten, because I am very grateful for that. And I do think that to me is the definition of success, that people have told me how much they've connected with the work or how much it's meant to them or how much their kids or they have loved reading it. And to me, really, that's it. When I have these moments of self-doubt,
you just have to remind yourself, right?
That is what it is ultimately. And honestly, it seems like it's the universe or somebody interfering to help me, because I've had these low moments where I'm just like, when Amina's voice wasn't selling or nothing seemed to be going. And it's just so slow, right? The industry is so slow. And you're like waiting and waiting and waiting for somebody to get back to you. And it was painful. And that's why I mentioned that I had a full-time job recently. It was because I was so frustrated with this world. And I thought, I'm just not producing enough. I'm not doing enough. I need to just get back to my other career then. Maybe that'll help stir things up. Got to that point where I just didn't feel like I was accomplishing anything. It just seems every time I'd get this beautiful email from somebody, you know, who I don't know, my website, saying how much they appreciated my book or what a difference it made. Something really touching.
Thank God for them slapping that reality back in your mind.
Yeah, it really was a gift. And so to me, that's it. Of course, sales are amazing and words are amazing and all that. But ultimately, having people say that these books matter and that it matters to them and made a difference to them in some way is how I define success.
Absolutely. It is so scary and toxic how our own doubts can really pollute our entire mind and not even allow these wake-up calls of like how actually okay we're doing in life. We just completely allow our doubts to take over. I am glad that you have these nice reminders along the way, like, hey, you know, you changed your life, so thank you. It's like, all right, I'm doing just fine. I know we were also mentioning that you said you had a picture book before. Is this your Curious George celebrating Ramadan?
That's one of them. That was huge for me.
I mean, Curious George.
Yeah.
Tell us how that opportunity came about.
Sure. So I had written two picture books prior to that Chronicle Books had published. So one is called Night of the Moon, which is a Ramadan story about a little girl named Yasmin and her family celebrating the month of Ramadan, and they're watching the moon change shape over the course of the month. And then the second picture book is called Golden Domes and Silver Lanterns. And it's a book of colors that introduce objects and concepts that are special to Muslims through like a very simple rhyming color concept book. I think the publisher of Curious George, it's part of a series actually, the Curious George Ramadan book. And they had been considering the idea of including Ramadan as part of a collection of other holiday books that had Curious George celebrating Hanukkah, Christmas, St. Patrick's Day, Halloween, Parades Day. And so they got in touch with me, and because they had seen the other picture books I had published and asked me what I thought about it. And, you know, this was something they were considering. And did I think that the Muslim community would be receptive to it? And would I be interested in writing it? Of course, I was overjoyed because it's Curious George, like you said. And I'd grown up reading it. I'd grown up reading Curious George to my kids. And I knew that I couldn't imagine anybody not loving the idea of it. And so that's how it came about. I wrote it, and I don't think anybody was prepared for the reaction I got. I knew it was going to be well received. I could only imagine after having seen the reaction to my other books that people would welcome it very happily. But I think it exploded because people were so moved by it. And I think it was a combination of the fact that it was the first mainstream character to ever include and represent Muslims in this way, but also the timing. It was right during primary election cycle. It was like, well, way. And there was just a lot of other stuff being said, and it was a lot of negativity. And so all of a sudden to have something really positive and hopeful and fun and cute come out that was saying, basically, look, Curious George has Muslim friends and they're okay. You know? Yeah. It was such a powerful message, really the right times. It ended up, you know, getting a lot of attention, and I ended up getting a lot of attention because of it, and interviews all over the place on TV and radio and all sorts of media, and over again, the same message, that the same conversations we keep having about diversity and representation and inclusion. Mm-hmm. But I think especially because it was Muslims, and at this time, because he'd celebrated Hanukkah, nobody really noticed. The fact that he was celebrating Ramadan was a really amazing thing to be a part of. And I was honored that they asked me. I was happy to write it. It's a cute little story that was fun to do. I think it just represented so much more.
How much of the process were you able to take full creative control in?
They sent me the other books in the series. So it's actually different than other Curious George stories, the classic ones, like you've probably read Curious George Goes to the Hospital, or mm-hmm. Curious George Goes to the Fire Station. And there's always that, this is George, he's a good little monk, his friend with the man in the yellow hat. And then it goes on to him having his little adventure and getting into some kind of mishap and then everything resolving, right? There's that formulas for all of them.
Yeah.
And then there's new ones that people have written in the style of the original books, but they're more modern. You'll see ones like Curious George making pancakes or whatever. I can't remember some of the other stories. And I noticed them when I'd read them to my children because they were definitely more diverse. Like they'd have Black woman mayor at the end of the story, whereas the Curious George going to the hospital, all the nurses are women and the doctors are men. And, you know, it was like, you know, stuff that was representative of that time. I'm assuming a process in terms of imitating the writing style of the creators and the art and everything like that. These books were a little bit different because they were board books and they're tabbed. It actually varied from book to book, the ones that were done prior to mine. Some of them would have a little song on one of the pages. It was almost like little chapters. And sometimes the verse would change from one format of rhyming to another. Even the level of content varied. So if it was something about St. Patrick's Day, just very light and not a lot of explaining, I would say.
Gotcha.
And I felt like for me, like I wanted it to be more of a story than just like, let's bust into a Christmas song. I wanted to really highlight certain things about what fasting is, the idea of charity being a really important component of Ramadan, the idea of family gathering together to break a fast, and then the idea of Ramadan culminating in the Eid celebration. Very specific things I thought were important to get across. I ended up writing the book in continuous verse, so it's all the same throughout, but it's still divided up into these little chapters. In terms of what they allow, they were very hands-off, wrote the first draft, expecting actually more input. The one change they did ask me to make was I had Curious George be curious about what fasting would be like. The one thing I asked them, I was like, you know, how do you want to approach this? And we decided that Curious George would be celebrating Ramadan with Muslim friends. With that, then I thought, okay, if he decides to try fasting, and we have friends, colleagues who've done that, many people I know who decide to try fasting in solidarity or just to see what it's like with their Muslim friends. So it didn't seem that far off. So the first draft I wrote, he's curious about fasting. He tries it. His stomach is grumbling. He's dreaming of a giant banana, you know? And then he gets through it and he breaks his fast. The editors came back and said, well, we think that Curious George is really the spirit of a very young child, maybe 5 or 6 years old. So we think he's just too young for that. So instead of him actually fasting, could he be helping his friend fast? That was a change I made. So instead, his friend Kareem is going to try fasting for the first time. And George is curious, can he do it? He thinks he can, but he'll need some help. So during the day when his friend is fasting, Curious George keeps him busy and distracted and, you know, drags him away from the kitchen and, you know, things like that. Other than that, they were fine with everything else I wrote and the format and everything.
That must have been such an incredible experience, especially because I know we were talking about earlier how when you grew up reading, you didn't see anyone that you could relate to, that you really felt like resonated with you and your own personal experiences. And then to have this, it's like full circle. I wish it didn't take that long for access to books with more cultures. I do wish it was introduced earlier for our generation, but you know what? I'm glad that it's happening.
Yeah.
What were some of the books that you loved reading growing up? And then I think for me, when I was reading books, I never really realized that there weren't characters that I could relate to. I still related to them because I was like, oh, I'm American. Like, this is their mm-hmm. experience. And it's funny. It wasn't until I was in middle school where I was verbally bullied and having my name made fun of and all that. That's when I realized, oh, I'm different. I was in middle school. Later in middle school, I came upon Amy Tan's works. And that's when I was like, holy shoot, this is a whole new world. I understand those Chinese words. And I'm like, I completely get what they eat for celebrations. When was it for you when you realized, oh, okay, that's my representation?
I think it was very similar to you. I was an avid reader. I spent lots of time in the library, had piles of books that I went through. I had a small collection of books at home between my sister, my older sister and I, and I would reread those books over and over again. And some of them were the Little House on the Prairie series. I read those a lot. I had a couple Beverly Cleary books that I loved and I read over and over again. And Little Women was the book that it was actually my sister's copy. And I would take it and I would read it and read it and read it. And when she'd get mad at me, she'd take it away, get it back. And it was interesting because now looking back, I'm like, I really didn't have that much in common with these characters technically. But like you said, I could relate to them, whether they lived in the 1800s or were on a prairie or grew up in the suburbs like Ramona Quimby. I just thought they were fantastic characters and they had experiences that I could relate to, whether it was having a sister or having parents and friends and feelings I identified with. I didn't feel it. But it's interesting to look back now as an adult and realize the fact that that was missing did impact me. And I only see it now in my own writing that I had as a child. And I actually have a family newspaper that I used to write for fun, where I would chronicle things in my family's life. And
oh my God, I love that. That's so creative.
It was funny because it's on notebook paper and I wrote the sections and I called it the Chronicles based on my
That's so cute.
But the funny thing is when I look back now, I eliminated all mention of my culture, my religion. It was fake news before it was fake. I left it out. It was there, but it wasn't there. You know, like I talked about my mom cooking for a party, but I didn't mention that she was making Pakistani food.
Do you think it was a conscious, intentional choice?
I think it was subconscious and I saved them. And so I just found them like last year and they're yellowed and I was looking through them and I was like, you know, it's just fascinating to like be back in yourself all these years later and realize I don't remember thinking that. I do remember feeling guilty when I embellished and I was aware of that because I was like, well, this is supposed to be news, but I'm taking liberties with what really happened. That type of thing. But like, I don't remember thinking, oh, I'm going to whitewash myself.
Oh, okay,
or like,
gotcha.
Cultural details. But that's what I did. And I just wonder now if it was subconscious because I wasn't reading anything.
I think it's all regurgitating what you were taking in.
Exactly. For me, it wasn't until even after high school, I think it was when I was in college, and I really started for the first time taking courses that interested me when I was taking a lot of literature classes and African-American history and things that I just felt like I didn't get enough of in my education. And I took a Caribbean literature class that really opened up my eyes. And I started searching for South Asian writers. And a lot of the ones I found were actually Indian women who were in India or immigrated as adults to the US or to the Western world. And it was nice to find that because I had seen nothing before, but I still couldn't relate to it as much as I probably related to Amy Tan, actually, because of that idea of being both. And it was something that was missing in even that the South Asian lit I was reading. So for me, it wasn't really until I read Jhumpa Lahiri. That was my shock of recognition moment where I was like, this is something I can completely understand and relate to in a way I had never before.
Jhumpa Lahiri's work is beautiful. I need to grab more of hers as well.
Yeah, it's not just for the sake of throwing in extra sensory details, you know, or like exotifying it. It just is. That's what I liked about it so much that I wasn't like, oh, the feel of the silky sari fabric, you know, like sometimes it's like too much. And I'm like, okay, in her case, like, especially the namesake, that novel just really hit me. And I think because of the immigrant story, like the parents, very much I could imagine my parents in those characters, but then also like the child that they raise and him growing up and balancing both. And her writing is just phenomenal. It makes me angry. It's so good. So, 'cause I'm like, I could never write like that.
Do you mind sharing a moment that was the most challenging time in your life?
Wow. I think probably the hardest time in my life was coming to grips with my father's demise, or I wish they'd decline and then eventual demise. It was something I had just never experienced before. And I think having grown up the child of him and my mom who immigrated here and left their family behind, I never really knew my grandparents and I never saw them age. So for me, like the experience of seeing my parents age and to see him age was so shocking and jarring for me. I think that entire process of seeing him slowly decline and feeling so helpless to do anything about it.
Was it something like dementia?
It was really just old age and a combination of heart problems and diabetes and then the intersection of those things. The last couple of years of his life was just a spiraling downward. For me, it was that. It was like, I know this is life, but it was something that as a child, I was so terrified of. And I mean, I know we all are.
I grew up thinking my parents are going to live forever.
Yeah. So I think for me, grappling with that whole feeling of seeing someone you love so much slowly withering away. In his case, seeing that I think he was depressed as he aged and wasn't feeling well, didn't articulate it, and we didn't know how to help him. And just that helplessness feeling, I think, was so hard for me. And I think in terms of overcoming it, I think it was just, like you're saying, this is life. It's an eventuality that we all have to deal with. And now it's just a matter of making sure I do as much as I can for my mom while I still have her. I mean, I tried with my dad. There's always that feeling later on where you're like, what might I have done? And dealing with that too. Could I have done anything differently? Could I have done more? Really, I think it's that. And then trying to have a sense of humor about it. And now as I'm getting older, and like really thinking about it, my husband, I'm like, you know, we need a plan because this is not fun. What are we going to do about this? That was probably the most challenging part of my life. And then honestly, not having him around now to see what's happening. He passed away 3 years ago, right when a lot of big things were starting to happen for me. So not having him here, it's life. And at the same time, he lived a long, beautiful life. And that's the thing I think about. This is the normal of life. He lived to be 80. That's incredible. And I think a big lesson for me was learning about other people's loss and how so many other things in life that you don't appreciate until you've gone through it. I realized yes. I couldn't understand other people's loss until I had experienced it myself. And just in terms of build that empathy that wasn't there. It's like something I don't really talk about that much. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that seriously, because I usually check in with the listeners to see, you know, what they've been working on. And then a lot of them shared with me and I was so surprised that a lot of the listeners who are quite young, their parents passed away. But a lot of them I see, they weave it into their writings. It's always going to be a part of them and it does shape their work that they produce. And I have to say, it's very powerful not to even try to lessen or minimize any death. Yeah. But I'm like, I don't think the writing would have been as powerful or as vivid or as detailed or what it is now if it weren't for their experience.
Absolutely. I'm working on an illustrated chapter book series right now for Salaam Reads.
Oh wow,
and
congrats.
Thank you. And it's a lighthearted, fun series about a 10-year-old kid who loves basketball, and he's a third generation Pakistani American. So he's like my kids. So he's a little bit more removed than Amina is from the culture. So he gets this different, really fun perspective where it's the grandparents that are the cultural ones. And I'm having a great time writing it, but it's a theme that I am introducing, and not the death, but the illness. How many kids have to deal with that? Grandparents being sick, and it's a part of their life. And it was something that, you know, like I said, I didn't experience my grandparents aging, and obviously my kids did and are. And so I think it's, you know, something I just wanted to weave in. So the third book I'm working on does have that element in there where grandpa gets sick, because that's something that kids are dealing with, and I think it's important.
I'm very excited for that book.
Oh, thank you.
Hannah, I wish you so much happiness, and I don't even want to wish you luck because I don't think you need the luck, but I'm going to say I'm going to wish you a very smooth and productive writing timeline leading
Thank
up to
you.
When it's due.
That's what I need, yeah.
Please do share your social media so we know where to find you and say hi.
Yeah, please follow me on Facebook. You can find me, I think it's like Hannah Khan Author. There's also Hannah Khan the Actress.
Oh, yes. I did notice that when I did my research.
Yeah, it's actually really funny. I think a lot of people from other parts of the world confuse us. And so I have an inordinate number of followers who I do not think are interested in children's literature. So it's Hannah Khan on Facebook, and then also Hannah Khan Books on Twitter and Instagram. So I'd love to be connected.
Amazing. The community, they're very, very sweet and they're so thoughtful. So they'll be very excited to connect with you.
Love that. And I'd love to hear anyone's thoughts on what we've talked about or about my books or anything.
I love how engaged you are. I appreciate that. I think that's really cool of you. Thank you, Hannah. It was lovely talking to you.
It was a pleasure, honestly.
And that wraps up our episode with Hannah Khan. Hannah, I had a really wonderful time with you on the show. Thank you for such an honest and heartfelt conversation. Storytellers, thank you so much for listening in. I hope you took a lot from Hannah's episode. Please hop on over to Twitter and say hi to Hannah at Hannah Khan Books, and head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Hannah Khan. Don't forget, if you haven't had the chance to yet, I would love to ask for your support in taking a moment to subscribe to 88 Cups of Tea on iTunes and leave a rating and a review. When you take those specific actions, that really helps our show become more visible to new listeners who haven't heard of us before, and we're really trying to get the word out about our podcast. Producing a podcast takes a lot of time, and we put a lot of heart and soul into making 88 Cups of Tea. Thank you so much in advance for helping us grow the community. I really appreciate you. If you'd also love to support our show by rocking 88 Cups of Tea swag, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/mug to get your limited edition mug signed by yours truly. It works perfectly for your daily dose of tea or coffee or even wine. Don't forget to join our private Facebook group if you want to hang out with fellow writers and 88 Cups of Tea listeners. I'm so excited to see you in there. You can find us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you next Thursday in episode 100. I cannot believe we're already there.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.